Everybody's paying, they're paying attention. Everybody's paying, they're paying attention now. Everybody's paying, they're paying attention. Everybody's paying attention now. Everybody's buying.
And this is the music show on RN, and in this hour we'll be paying attention to Eddie Perfect and celebrating Australian Music Month. Paying Attention Now is from Eddie Perfect's show Warn the Musical, and this performance is from the music show's own Adelaide Cabaret Festival show of 2006, when the Warn the Musical was being performed for the first time. Well, the writer and star of the show, Eddie Perfect, has gone on to pursue a very impressive career in performing and in writing. Most recently, I suppose, on stage in South Pacific and also on television in Offspring. I sat down with him a couple of weeks ago to talk about the perfect story so far, and I have to give a little language warning, which it comes up in one of the songs later on in this hour.
From Sri Lanka to Harare, in their turbans and their saris, people tough, the name is Bazi, was a hunter on safari, with the sword and the tsunami, and the strength of the
Eddie Perfect, welcome back to the music show.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Let's talk about singing. I mean, I'm guessing that singing is the start of things for you, maybe even the centre of things.
Yeah, it certainly is the start of things. I think it's important to move it away from the centre of things pretty quickly. Singing is probably most humans' entrance into the world of music, I think, and that was certainly mine. And I grew up singing along to music that we listened to in the house, but also got sent along at a very early age to Yamaha Music School in Malvern, where I sang in like a little Yamaha choir. And so singing has always been a part of my life. I've studied singing, you know, I studied classical singing at Melbourne University, and I studied it in Perth at WAPA. But I'm not as into singing as I used to be. There's two kind of schools of singing, really, I think. You know, there's the school where you desperately want to sound good, and then there's the other one, which I sort of subscribe to, which is, you know, I like my voice to be expressive, to communicate ideas, and that comes first, and then sounding good comes somewhere after that. Clarity and communication is what I kind of aspire to, and you know, like being able to sacrifice, it's, you know, it's being able to sacrifice sounding nice in order to find a character is important, I think.
Yeah, I'm very suspicious of singers who aim to sound nice the whole time. I think they're missing the point, really, don't you?
Yeah, and you also, you've got to be true to the way your voice, your own voice sounds. Everyone's voice is kind of different, and I think a lot of singers are trying to sound like someone else that they probably admire or another type of sound they aspire to, when really it's finding your own unique voice that's the most interesting, I think. And I haven't had a singing lesson since 2001, but I think, you know, I can do more with my voice than I used to be able to. In some ways I can do less, I guess. I've probably abused my voice quite severely, but also it does more, you know, and I push it and pull it and scream and shout, and I just try not to worry about that. But I remember at college being very worried about my voice, having to go to bed early and, you know, get lots of sleep before singing, and being kind of hyper conscious of what my voice was doing in the morning and how it was going to sound. And I really, you know, I don't worry about that stuff anymore.
No, I mean, you've got to take care of it to some extent, because if it conks out on you, you're stuffed, aren't you? But
yeah, that's right. And I've done that before. There's nothing worse than any singer knows that doing a show where you've lost your voice and you still have to do it, which I've had to do before, is excruciating. It's like, you know, playing table tennis with your hands tied behind your back.
Did it lead you to writing, do you think, the singing?
Yeah, I think it certainly helped. I think if you're writing songs, you've got to be able to sing them, even if you're not a great singer. Like, I know a lot of songwriters who sing that aren't great singers, you know, like Stephen Sondheim would be one of those. Like, he's not a great singer, but, you know, he obviously can sing. I mean, you've got to have an idea of what a voice can do, how, you know, how a lyric is going to come out, whether, you know, whether things are possible in the song, rather, you know, coming from a completely non-singing perspective would be difficult, because you'd probably ask a singer to do things they can't do. But, I think it's a really great way to get into writing, you know. Like, I think it'd be very difficult to write songs without that ability.
Of course, if you're talking about Sondheim, or if you're talking about musical theatre in general, and you've obviously recently been involved in musicals quite a bit, then we're not necessarily talking about a need for a classically trained voice, are we? We're talking about, I suppose, actors who can put over a song, and sometimes that means acting, being able to sing.
Yeah, that's right. It's a really weird fine line. I mean, I guess every performer finds their niche, or the things that they're good at, you know. And I kind of looking back, I was standing in the wings of about to go on in South Pacific and talking to John Zintervallonis, who plays Stewpot in the show, to my Luther Billis, and we were laughing about the fact we've done a couple of shows together now, including Thripney Opera, that Malthouse Victorian Opera collaboration, and how we kind of haven't really done a show where we just sing in a nice kind of voice, in our normal voice. It's always some kind of crazy snarling character voice or an accent or something weird like that. And that's the way it goes. You know, you make a choice at the start of it, and that's, you end up following all that all the way through. But it really depends. Like with Shane Warne the musical, when I wrote that and cast it, I needed people who could sing gospel and soul and R&B and get their voice around that, because that was just this palette of the whole show. You know, this idea that it was a big kind of foot stomping revivalist sort of celebration of this guy's life. So that required specific vocalists for it. But then there are moments in there where it's not so necessary. You know, it's a difficult thing. You can get people that can act really well through a song and probably not aren't great vocalists. And that's fine. But then, you know, if you turn around and say, oh, I also need you to sing alto in all these gospel harmonies through the whole show, that might be more of a challenge for them.
Yes. So I suppose then different sorts of musicals require different things. But I mean, certainly, I mean, if Sondheim has written your musical, you want to hear the words, don't you? And very often actors are going to be better at doing that than classically trained singers.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You know, the trick is to try, I guess, to try and do both, you know. And, you know, you are kind of called upon to have all of those skills. But it's like anything, when you turn up to rehearsals, no one wants to see an actor working on their singing technique. That's all supposed to be bedded down. So all you're concerned about is acting in the show. And there'd be varying degrees of people's voices. Like, for example, with South Pacific, we had everyone from Teddy Tahu Rhodes, who has, you know, an incredible operatic sound, you know, and he doesn't have to think about that. That's his technique. So when he gets into the room, all he thinks about is trying to act through the song. But just the instrument he's got or he's developed is this, you know, bass baritone operatic sound, which is incredible. Whereas, you know, someone like myself or Kate Sobrano, you know, come from a kind of contemporary music background, and we approach that very differently, you know. And our characters are such that we, you know, required to bend and twist our voices and make a conscious choice to go, how is a Vietnamese kind of worker who's been, you know, imported into the South Pacific to pick coconuts for French planters going to sing? You know, that's a weird thing to ask yourself. And then, you know, my character Luther Billis, how is, you know, a kind of a used car salesman from the Bronx who's found himself in the construction segment of the Navy going to sound, you know, very working class. It would be odd if I was, you know, trying to sound lovely and operatic, you know. So I, you know, I just kind of snarl my way through it, and it's, you know, and I think that's kind of appropriate.
So are there remnants, would you say, in your in your singing of, you know, those lessons that you had of the classical training you had. Did any of it stand you in good stead? Is there anything you still call on?
Yeah, all of it goes into making your voice the kind of muscle that it is. You know, it's once you've developed that muscle, you know, you've got to exercise it, but it's generally always there, or at least you have a level that you don't drop below. I'm really fortunate that I've got, you know, I think it was a combination of things. You know, it was a combination of singing as a job before I even went to Whopper or to Melbourne Uni. Like, I was singing with a South African guy, Valunga Khoza, and we were gigging all over the place and singing in bands. And I got past that preciousness, that vocal preciousness. You know, I learnt where the limitations were, but I also learnt that, you know, you can do a gig and then stay up all night drinking and then get in a tour bus and go to the next town and sing. You know, it's going to come out. You know, it's not going to magically disappear. And, you know, it's not ideal, but it's possible. You know, you can sing through tonsillitis. You can sing through anything, really, as long as it's not your actual larynx that's affected. You know, if you've got laryngitis, obviously, and that's right at the core of where you're making your sound. Everywhere else just feels bad, but it's not impossible. So, I got pretty hardy out of doing all of that. And also, you know, having a technique means that it's always in a spot that's generally safe. You know, even kind of unsafe sounds, I managed to kind of put into a place that I can endure, and it doesn't seem to do any lasting damage, you know, and I've worked that out about myself. And also, you know, you just, as you get, I'm 35, well, nearly 35 now, and I think that's, you know, it's a good age for voices, you know, that's sort of settled in and you know what it can do and you can kick it around a bit, and it's got, you know, it doesn't sound nice and pristine. Like, I used to hate that about my voice. It used to sound too lovely, you know, and it was always the thing that I hated too, is, you know, being in the kind of show or creating the kind of work that meant you came off and some little old lady said, oh, you've got a lovely voice. I thought that would be the worst. That would be the worst thing that could happen to me, because I'd seen it happen all the time, you know. Oh, isn't that boy lovely? Isn't he got a lovely voice? I couldn't think of anything worse. You know, I wanted it to be about the ideas, you know. If it was that unengaging that they just sat there listening to the sound of someone's voice, that was a big thumbs down for me.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN, and I'm talking to Eddie Perfect, who doesn't have a lovely voice. But, I mean, it's interesting that you said that. I wonder whether some of your early satirical stuff, which was, you know, some of it was reasonably over the top, was this an attempt to kind of keep the old ladies at bay?
Yeah, a lot of my early stuff was a reaction. It's a weird thing to realise that it came from a reactionary place, but it came from a reaction to something that probably most people wouldn't really care about or even know about. It was a reaction to the kind of cabaret that was going on, which was unemployed music theatre performers between gigs, basically singing their audition songs, woven together with some kind of narrative about their, you know, their middle class lives. And it was deeply uninteresting, and it was kind of vacuous, and it was, you know, really show and telly. Mm. And I went to a lot of them. I played piano for a lot of them, and, you know, I was in that world, and I just reacted to the fact that it didn't say anything, didn't speak to me. You could feel nothing through the whole thing. So I was like, oh, no, I don't care if people are disgusted or horrified. They're going to feel something when they come and see my shows. And I also saw how, you know, cherry-picking songs across, you know, from no matter where you pick them from, the canon of the American Songbook or from popular music or wherever people were plucking songs from, it was generally to highlight something in the narrative of their show, but it never really nailed it. You know, it was always a bit of a square peg in a round hole. And I thought, you know, well, the obvious way to combat that is to custom write your songs for your narrative so that everything goes together and it's seamless. So I was really desperate to do that as well. And I also saw that there was this kind of, with music theatre in particular, because it takes a certain sort of person from a certain socioeconomic background to be sent along to music lessons and, you know, singing lessons and acting and to do what is in a kind of a, quite an indulgent career, really, when you think about it. There's a bit of a debt to mum and dad going on, I reckon, that, you know, once you undergo all that training and you climb the lofty heights and you get into a musical and you get to invite your mum and dad along, and there's a proud moment where they get to say, yes, all that work was worthwhile and thanks, mum and dad, and isn't it great? And let's have a champagne in the foyer, which is nothing wrong with that at all, except that it kind of created this weird culture in cabaret where it was about pleasing a certain generation of people. It was about kind of packaging yourself into this nice, neat little package that could be easily consumed by baby boomers. And I was really anti that as well. I didn't want to make it easy or comfortable for that audience, even though that was probably the primary audience that came along. And because I wanted to connect with a young audience, I thought, why can't people my age come and see the kind of stuff I'm doing? Why does it just have to be this boomer generation consuming theatre? So I sort of set about trying to horrify those people. And because there's no reason to sell out in cabaret, because there's nothing to sell out for, there's no money and there's certainly no glory, you might as well say exactly what it is you want to say. And so I was pretty adamant about doing that, and that was both good and bad, and continues to be both good and bad. Like, for example, the Adelaide Cabaret Festival, just recently I did my show Miss Anthropology, and it's, despite all these intentions of going, all right, well, I want to write another show for myself, let's try and make it something that a broad audience can enjoy, it just ended up being the darkest thing I've ever written. And I had a reviewer kind of bail me up after the show, you know, who enjoyed the show but thought that I swore too much, and why you don't need to swear to be clever, that thing. I get that a lot. Yep. You know, why don't you just take the swear words out? And you know, because I don't just dismiss people, I sort of think about what it is they've got to say and what would it be like if I just removed the swear words. There's a couple of things going on. One is that swear words are really good to put in to the meter of your song to help with rhyming and just the pentameter kind of rhythm that's going on. It's great to fill out syllables. That's one kind of lazy reason. But the other thing I thought too was that it's me, you know, like that's the way I choose to express myself, and it makes... I don't think they're separable, and I think that it's odd that people come to you and they like generally what you're doing, but they want to make it okay for themselves, more okay for themselves, and I just don't, I just refuse to do that. I don't see why you would. I think you would lose more than just swear words. Like, I've taken swear words out of songs to perform them on radio, for example, and it's kind of fine, but it's kind of not, because the theatre is, you know, the live theatre and live comedy is one of the last places where you can go and see things that aren't sanitized. You know, if you turn on the television, that there's a code of practice involved. And I love that in theatre there is no code of practice. And it's probably the last place where you can see pretty full-on ideas and hear some direct language and be surprised and shocked and made to feel uncomfortable. We've sort of fixed that in every other area of our lives. And theatre is generally free from that. And I think it's good to exploit that.
I have a vision, a wondrous vision, a vision beautiful that no one's seen before. I see children, their faces plastic, and there's a yellow pony lying on the floor. And then there's music, some subtle music, and then there's nothing, then there's something, then there's not, then people moving, then people stopping. Yes, I think they'll stop, then move, then stop a lot. Then they'll be singing, perhaps Cole Porter. It's quite traditional, but in this context, new. And then a woman, dressed in a squid suit, will dance with other squid, her nipples painted blue. And then there's silence. Utter silence. I find silence quite confronting, don't you think? And then weird noises, maybe some chorus of a Verdi opera played on kitchen sinks. And we'll need hours, just fucking hours, so many hours banging on and on and on. People will hate it, but say they love it, cause it's been going on for far too fucking long. And then young boys, all with
This is the music show on RN. I'm talking to Eddie Perfect. Let's talk about the non-satirical writing that you've done, because I think in a way you kind of created a rod for your own back in a sense with the satire, because I think people assume now that every time you open your mouth you're being funny, and that every time you write a song it's a comic song, and if you put on a show called Shame Worn the Musical, or indeed even write a song cycle like Songs from the Middle, that it's meant to be belly laugh territory, and it's not really true, is it?
No, it's not. Yeah, it's not. I mean, every idea is generally, you got to know what you're going to put on the show. So, you know, you don't write a song cycle about suburban men tone and then try and put it in the comedy festival. You know, you got to know where to put your work. It's also very difficult to communicate what a work is going to be to an audience who are used to you being one thing. They're kind of challenges, really. And I mean, people, when it came to Shame Worn the Musical, for example, would always say to me, "Oh, it's a piss take on Worn, right? That's what it is." And it kind of was, but it kind of wasn't. I mean, I like the idea of Shane Warne the Musical because it really sort of sat on the fence between what could be either a really great or a really terrible idea. And it sort of seemed like subject matter that just wouldn't work for a musical. And I wasn't sure of it too until I sort of researched and I went, yeah, actually it is right. And I like that unexpectedness, you know. But that also is a double-edged sword, you know. The people are going, that just sounds terrible to me. But the way I went about writing it was, you know, generally people have quite a kind of lofty, snobbish attitude to Shane Warne, because he kind of represents everything that's terrible and good about, you know, the Australian male. And I'd ask people about, what do you think of Shane Warne? And, you know, people were divided down the middle. But there were some massive character assassinations going on by people who had never met this guy or didn't really know the full story or had just gotten their information from some very unreliable sources, like, you know, kind of tabloid media and glossy mags and stuff like that. And so my job, I thought, was to try and change people's minds about Shane. And in doing that, I probably fictionalized a lot about what he sort of thinks and feels. Because I think, you know, one of the endearing things about Shane is that he's not self-reflective. He just goes, he makes mistakes, but he doesn't dwell on them. He just moves forward, and he's probably one of the happiest human beings on the planet. And, yeah, that was my challenge with the show. And yeah, comedy is a great way to deliver serious ideas. Like, I wouldn't ever write a serious piece about ideas that I thought were serious. But you know, I like some of my favorite writing sort of sits in between being comic and being melancholy. You know, for me, it's about treating seemingly untreatable subjects in song or in music or in theatre. And the romanticism of times past sort of weighs in the air when it comes to writing. You think, oh, well, I can't, you know, there are songs about New York City and there are songs about streets in New York and all these sort of famous places in America, and we've imported all that stuff, and because it's from far away and it's not our town, we, you know, we go, oh, yeah, great, you know, 52nd Street Blues, we can get on board with that, but we don't do it with our own places because we know what they are. And I kind of wanted to counter that. You know, there's no reason why 99%, if not 100% of our lives is spent in shopping centres and food courts and car parks and, you know, mass chain restaurants and, you know, these very urbanised environments that we live in, and all of the things of life still happen in them. You know, we have love and loss and elation and triumph and tragedy, and all those things happen. But they happen in places that we don't necessarily imbue with the same romanticism as places we're used to hearing in other songs. And I kind of want to counter that. So, that, for example, I've written a song about IKEA, and I've written a song about my sister working at Bunnings and, you know, what that meant. And I think it's possible, and I think it has a really interesting effect on an audience. There's always, like, the first lyric comes out and people laugh, and then they settle into something more serious when they just go, okay, well, this song just happens to be set in IKEA, but now that we've laughed laughed about that because we didn't think we'd be hearing a song that involved any kind of relationship to IKEA. Now we're just going to listen to the story, and that becomes the backdrop of the particular tale you're telling. And I love doing that. It's kind of mythologizing our own culture and taking things that are really, really kind of soulless. Like, you know, I feel like my entire life growing up, you know, I worked as a kitchen hand at Red Rooster, for God's sakes, you know, and spent a lot of time in food courts, you know, and bowling alleys and arcades, you know, like places that are really, you know, mass produced. You could go inside one, in any city, any town, in any part of Australia, and it would be the same. And I want to kind of reclaim that and romanticize it. So that's what I like. That's what I like doing.
It's also playing with people's expectations, isn't it? Because I mean, on the one hand, you've got, if you go out to Shane Warne, the musical, you've got people who everybody thinks they know about Shane Warne. I mean, everybody has an opinion about Shane Warne. It may be an informed opinion. It probably isn't that informed an opinion. Doesn't matter. From your point of view, it means that your audience is, they're all there and they all know something. And then you can use that. You can, you know, pull the rug from under their feet and say, well, no, actually, he's not like that. He's like this. Yeah. And it's different. I mean, whereas if you start with a character you've invented, you've got to tell them everything.
That's right. That's right.
And it's the same with the suburbs. Everybody, you know, you said before that you wouldn't put a show about suburban Mentone in a comedy festival. But, you know, I think probably most people would expect that that's exactly where it would go because people think that the suburbs are funny. There's something funny about suburbia. But and again, if you can take that, you can use it to your advantage.
Yeah, it is true. And you're kind of working out, well, what is the story? I mean, I would never attempt to write a show about Mentone if I didn't have this classical ensemble at my disposal for this show. Originally, when the Australian National Academy of Music came to me and said the Brodsky Quartet are coming over to do some workshops and we want them to do a show, would you be interested in working with them? And of course, I said yes straight away. And they said, you know, we just thought we'd take, you know, some of your songs and rearrange them for string quartet and some of our players. And I just thought that was, you know, that was a waste of an opportunity. And I just said, no, I want to write a show. And I came up with the idea of writing about Mentone. And it's good to have every show to have like a little challenge, you know. So basically I went back to Mentone. It was just like turning over rocks and seeing where I could find songs. And
you researched, you know, it.
Yeah. And like, where are these songs going to be? You know, are they going to be in, you know, are they going to be in the streets, and are they going to be in the history of the place, or are they going to be in, you know, the present or in the past? And it was a kind of a big deal personally for me to go back, you know, to stand outside the St. Patrick's Catholic Church, the church that, you know, my family and I went to every single bloody Sunday, and to reflect on my, you know, Catholic primary education, and, you know, to go to the football field, which is home to, you know, a lot of failure, personal failure, and it was lovely and weird, you know. It was me writing that show was kind of like a love letter to a place I didn't want to live ever, and to go, you know, the things that I thought were really bad weren't really so bad. I was probably just being a bit melodramatic, but and that, you know, This is where people live. People live in places like these all over the world, and everything about their life is just as important as everyone else's lives, and the events are just that shape them are just as large, and they need to be honoured. And you could probably go from suburb to suburb all the way across Australia and write a show for each one. You know, I find that really interesting. I don't reckon there's any place, any workplace, any office, any suburb, any town that you couldn't walk into and find a whole bunch of songs, because everyone's got a story and everyone's got a relationship to a place.
What about musically, Eddie? We've talked about the words a lot, and we've talked about singing and putting stories across. But how do you find the right notes to write a song about? You know, your sister working at Bunnings, for instance.
I always start with people. You know, people say, oh, "Do you start with the lyrics or do you start with the music?" And I always start with the idea. Like, I can't everything I write before I have an idea is rubbish. You know, even if it sounds pretty or it reads cleverly, if it's unattached to an idea, it's pretty worthless. So I've got a bunch of bits of musical ideas that I just wrote in abstract that are sitting on a hard drive that I've, you know, I always say to myself, I'm going to shoehorn them into something one day, and I never do. And if I do, they're like little poisonous barbs in a song that I just feel like a fraud. I go, that doesn't belong there. That that came before the idea, and it's an imposter. So, you know, I start with the idea, and then where the music comes from, I really don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. It's you know, kind of cliched way that all songwriters say. There's this, you know, there's a feeling when you write something that, you know, you don't make it happen. You kind of get out of the way, and it comes from somewhere. And that you're basically developing skills to get out of your own way, to be able to hear what's going on behind the sort of firewalls of noise and crap you've got in your head, you know. And that's why a lot of writing is basically, you know, 90% spending time at the piano, playing through all of your habits and rituals and patterns that are bland and uninteresting, and kind of smashing your head until you break through to something that's genuinely interesting and new. That's my experience. And sometimes it comes really, that's why I like writing in the morning, because I haven't had a chance for my conscious mind to start messing up the joint with, you know, boring bits of information. And I don't know, I kind of generally go, I want this to be, you know, a ballad, you know, so I'm not going to start playing this quickly. I'm going to settle into it. Or, you know, it'd be great if it had this kind of genre feel, like whether it's going to be, you know, Ennio Morricone sort of Western or... And my sister worked at Bunnings was an interesting one, because it started with this clarinet solo with the melody, and I got to do more of that with Songs from the Middle, having an ensemble of instrumentalists playing away. It meant that, you know, you could do stuff where it didn't require me to sing. So the whole opening of that was this clarinet solo of the melody, and it sounds like, you know, I don't know, like kind of an Eastern European, very sad ballad. And I remember a similar thing happening on Tom Waits' album, Alice. He's got a song called Poor Edward, I think it is. It was a circus freak who had a woman's face on the back of his head, and that eventually drove him mad. And the song begins with this violin playing the melody. And so I kind of borrowed that idea for the Bunnings song. And it's great because in the end, the violin takes over the melody, and you can just see, it was basically the story of a small hardware store being run out of business by Bunnings, and the manager and the owner of the small hardware store is being bankrupt by the large multinational, well, you know, national chain, actually taking a job at Bunnings and working for a man in his 20s as a supervisor. And the image of this guy, you know, working for the company that put him out of business stocking shelves is kind of there without you having to put it into lyrics. You know, that last violin solo, I can just imagine seeing a broken man, you know, putting things on a shelf in a humongous store. That was a very sad image. I love that kind of stuff. I don't know why I'm laughing. It's tragic, but it, you know, it's good.
When I was young, my sister worked at Bunnings. Saturday morning, she put on her uniform. Shopped for their hardware needs and such. I remember well, my sister worked at Bunnings when construction finished and they opened up. Is is how we hate to change. The station three ranges, and we its weary players either don't keep up, won't keep up, leap ahead, or just pretend it doesn't really matter in the end. Oh, Solomon, my sister worked at Bunnings. There she saw the owner of that local hardware store. If you cannot beat them, join them. This, she swore, he said.
You mentioned earlier, Eddie Perfect, that you've been in a couple of musicals recently, Threepenny Opera and South Pacific, actually, not just any old musicals. We're talking about two of the classics, I suppose, of the 20th century. Did you learn much from them? I'm not thinking so much as a performer, but as a writer of musicals yourself.
Yeah. Both of them are really interesting. They're very, incredibly different. Yeah, they're almost polar opposites in the sense that with the Threepenny Opera, the story just stops and we get a song. We get a song and it doesn't necessarily even have anything to do with what's going on in the narrative. We're going to sing you a song now and it stops. And then South Pacific is the opposite. It's one of the best, most integrated music theatre scores, you know. Song and dialogue weave in and out of each other in a very masterful way, and the underscore and incidental music is always repeating the themes and kind of... bringing them back in varying ways, and it's creating this constant sort of thematic language that's going on all the time and flavouring what's going on. It's quite filmic, actually, the way it works. So they're very different in that respect. The reason that I think, you know, Threepenny Opera was interesting, but it was a deliberate, you know, in terms of making theatre, it was a deliberate attempt to unnerve an audience and keep them at bay and not try to lie to them that they're investing in any kind of real narrative or story, or to loot that, you know, deliberately distances the audience so they don't lose themselves in it and be swept up in it. It's everything about that show is jarring and wrong footing. And
there's no chance of old ladies coming up afterwards, actually, is there, and saying how nice your voice is?
No, it's not that kind of show, whereas South Pacific is, you know. Like, I always joke about there's... When we were doing Shane Warne the musical at the Athenaeum, there was Wicked was in the Regent Theatre opposite, and every night our show came down, you know, about 20 minutes before Wicked did, and there would be a horse and carriage out the front of the Regent, or a couple of horse and carriages ready to take people on a, you know, like a ride through the streets of Melbourne after the show, but no horse and carriage ever pulled up out the front of Warnie. And I was like, well, there's either, you know, you're either riding a horse and carriage show or you're not. And South Pacific is a horse and carriage show, and the Threepenny Opera isn't. And what I love is, you know, these guys, it's their job to ride horses around, but they're, in their own unique way, they're really reviewing music theatre. They know who's going to ride and who isn't. And I love that, you know, that's... Yeah, it's funny. So, Sydney Opera, there's no horses and carriages out the front of that. It's, everything about it is jarring and wrong-footing, and I personally like that. I think it's interesting. But it doesn't sweep you up into the story. You don't lose yourself in it. You don't feel great. You can't pull it on like a little, like a warm cloak.
No, no. And I know what you mean about the horse and carriage show, you know, being South Pacific, of course. And it is. It's big and it's glitzy. And yet, of course, it also turns the tables somewhat on the audience, doesn't it? Because it turns out to be a show which is partly, at least, about racism.
Yeah.
And it's it's kind of a shocking moment, I think, in the midst of all of this good time that everybody's having.
Yeah, and it's great because, you know, you fall in love with this Nellie Forbush character. She's like distilled down quintessential American as apple pie, girl next door, beautiful woman that everyone kind of desires, and she can, you know, she relates to people of the officer class just as well as she relates to people of the, you know, the mechanics and the CBs. You know, she's genuine and lovely, you know, but she's racist. And there's this quite an incredible scene where she has been avoiding Emil, doesn't want to marry him, but kind of has been avoiding telling him. And then he kind of corners her and says, why don't you want to marry me? Is it because of my children? And she says no, and he says, was it because of my wife? And basically forces her to say, yeah, it's because you had a Polynesian wife. And it's like, you just cringe, you go, oh my god. She basically says, yeah, it's because I'm racist, that's why I can't marry you. I'm sorry, it's just born in me and that's all there is to it. And you're like, oh whoa. So it's really hard to see this woman that you love being painted into this corner, having to go, yeah, I'm racist. And it's almost like, you know how people see themselves as good people, so when they're confronted with, you know, their own prejudices, there's no room, there's no place for that to go, because you go, well, it can't fit because I'm a nice person. And I think that's really quite a compelling scene. People are like, oh, man, yeah. And unquestionably, it's sort of still around, you know. We still have latent, well, of course we have racism, you know. It manifests in different ways, but I think that's why it's still powerful to people.
Yes. Colonial Australia. People whisper that you're writing a new musical on this subject. Is it, first of all, can you confirm or deny this? And secondly, it's true.
Yeah, I am. I kind of always think I'm going to play my cards closer to my chest. There's a line between going out too early with something you intend on writing, because there's every chance that you go, oh, yeah, I know I said I was going to write about outer space, but I've changed my mind, and it's kind of hard to go back on it. But I've done enough work, you know, research now, that I'm sure that, you know, that I'm going to be able to get to the next stage. And by saying, yeah, I'm going to write this piece, it's good. It means that I'm forced to do it because people are expecting it. But yeah, I've been looking for a new subject to write a big musical. I mean, like a big proper musical. And as we were talking before, you know, the process of being in South Pacific was like being in a writing workshop, you know, to see how scenes develop into songs and back into scenes, and just the storytelling at work has been really inspiring. And I want to write a piece about the first 4 years of white settlement in Australia, so from 1788 to 1792, or the, you know, the end of 1791, basically when Governor Phillip arrived and when Governor Arthur Phillip went back to England. And I don't know how I'm going to do it yet, because I haven't started writing the music. I'm just reading, and it's amazing. It's an amazing period, you know. It's probably the period in which there was the most amount of goodwill between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. They were trying very, very hard within their own paradigms, you know, which included believing that Indigenous people were pretty much animals. They were trying to get along, and there was, you know, good intentions, but it was, you know, basically, you know, it was a domino that was just about to knock over the rest of the dominoes forever up until today. It was basically the beginning of a very disastrous experiment. And by the time they realised how disastrous it was way too late, you know. And so, you know, I'm often writing about, you know, the back end of Australian culture and politics and our relationship to Indigenous people. And I just thought, wouldn't it be good to go back to the very beginning and to write something that's funny and musical and dark about those first 4 years and those incredible characters and what they did. And also because I was writing a proposal for it around about Australia Day. And, you know, I was on Facebook. I kind of use Facebook for work. I just kind of, I'm friends with anyone. Does anyone wants to be a friend, jump on board. It's not a personal site. It's just like a bit of work and a bit of fun. So I get, you know, in my feed, I get like everyone's status updates from people I've never met, I don't know. And, you know, that can be kind of interesting. You know, it's like staring into a portal of despair and weirdness. But on Australia Day, there was a startling amount of kind of racist status updates, you know, and because of, you know, the events at the Tent Embassy and the burning of the Australian flag and, you know, a lot of people that, you know, love the flag were getting very angry. And I thought, this is crazy, you know, we're nearly in 2013 and we still don't have a national day that we can all celebrate together. We want to, and I think we should be able to celebrate whatever it is that this nation has become, and our, you know, and all the people that are involved in it. There should be a day when we come together that brings us all together. But having Australia Day, the day that basically white people arrived and said, you know, you don't exist and this is our place and we're not leaving, it's always going to be a cause of concern for Indigenous people. How could it not be, right? And well, I'm not denying it didn't happen. It's about going, okay, let's find something that we can all enjoy together. So I thought, you know, rather writing about the back end of that, wouldn't it be great to go back to the beginning and to write about the very first Australia Day and to just be able to have an Indigenous and a non-Indigenous, you know, person side by side just going, it feels weird celebrating this, doesn't it? Because this is a disaster. And that, you know, it's more than 200 years ago, just going, well, it's always going to be like that, you know.
It sounds great. All you've got to do is write the music now.
Yeah, I just got to write it. And that's the thing, you know, I might sit down and just go, no, nah, it's just not writing.
But, you know. No, it'll be fine. It'll be fine.
Thanks. You'll be right.
Eddie Perfect, thank you very much for being my guest on The Music Show. It's been really good to talk to you again.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Ooh, with oil shall I anoint you? A table shall I prepare? Ooh, your cup will run over. I will meet you in the middle of the air. Come and meet me in the middle of the air. In my house you'll dwell forever. You shall not want for care. Surely goodness and mercy will follow you. I will meet you in the middle of the air. Come and meet me in the middle of the air. I will meet you in the middle of the air. Come and meet me in the middle of the air.
That's a Paul Kelly song, Meet Me in the Middle of the Air, and it was sung there by Eddie Perfect and Tripod. And they are part of the 30th birthday celebrations tomorrow for Hamer Hall in Melbourne. They're performing at 12:30 at Hamer Hall in St Kilda Road in the foyer. And they've got concerts in January as well, on the 18th and 19th of January at the Arts Centre in the Playhouse, Eddie Perfect and Tripod.